Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 25th of August, these are our main stories. The French President Emmanuel Macron says he wants to convince other leaders at the G7 summit he's hosting that tensions, especially over trade, are bad for everyone. The police, meanwhile, have used tear gas to drive back protesters near the meeting. Brazilian officials say hundreds of new fires are now burning in the Amazon region, adding to the pressure on President Bolsonaro. And tens of thousands of protesters have rallied against far-right extremism in the German city of Dresden ahead of regional elections. Also in this podcast,
part of the allegation involves a human in space, and that's where the interest occurs.
Was a crime committed by an astronaut on the International Space Station? As a host, it's sometimes difficult to enjoy your own party. Keeping the guests happy, particularly if some of them don't get along, can be a bit stressful. Such is the predicament of the French President Emmanuel Macron as he prepared to oversee a potentially fractious G7 summit in the French resort of Biarritz. Mr. Macron said he'd do everything he could to get the top industrial countries to agree to a strategy, particularly on trade. Global markets tumbled on Friday after President Trump's tweets about new tariffs on Chinese goods. Here's part of what Mr. Macron said on a televised address.
First of all, to convince all our partners that tensions, particularly trade tensions, are bad for everyone. We must succeed in having a form of de-escalation, that is, to stabilise things and avoid this trade war that is taking hold everywhere.
So how might Mr. Macron set about trying to reach an agreement on issues such as global trade? James Landale is at the G7 summit in a windy Biarritz in southwest France.
I think the advantage of the G7 format is it's relatively low-tech. It doesn't have armies of officials wandering around negotiating over text, not least because President Macron has decided to ditch the whole idea of a communique. And so it is still a chance for seven leaders to sit round a table together, both in meetings and dinners and things like that, and have those conversations face-to-face in some relative privacy and get their messages across. And so I think if Donald Trump, he will have to at least to give a hearing to the arguments put forward, not just by President Macron, but also the European Council President, Donald Tusk, also the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, in saying, look, you've got to de-escalate the trade war at the moment. So at least the G7 is a format in which Mr. Trump has to listen to those arguments. Whether it actually shapes what he does in the future is anybody's guess. And I think that most economic observers at the moment think that this trade war has some way to go before any settlement.
And James, you've been at the G7 meetings before. Donald Trump has not signed a communique in the past. He left early from one. What do you see as what they call the optics there, the body language? Do you see it as being relatively positive?
I think the difference at this G7 is that everybody's almost been open about the differences and say, look, yeah, actually, we disagree on these things. However, President Macron is putting up a valiant effort to try and, his words, revive the spirit of multilateralism, to try and find at least some issues where they can agree some kind of common ground. The problem they've got is, on many of the issues, there are huge differences, whether it's Iran, climate change, trade talks. So it might be, are there some areas within those issues where they can find some common ground so that they can have some kind of commonality at the end of it? But, I think expectations here are pretty low.
That was James Landale at the G7 summit in Biarritz. Meanwhile, French police fired water cannon on Saturday to drive protesters back from a bridge into the town of Bayonne on the route to the G7 summit. From there, Hugh Schofield reports.
Given the huge level of security in Biarritz itself, the flashpoint was always more likely to be in the neighbouring town of Bayonne, which, with its tradition of Basque radicalism, is well used to anti-police protests. As evening fell, a crowd of 300 or 400, some in black masks, moved up against police barriers on footbridges over the river and began hurling insults and projectiles. Police responded with tear gas and flashbang crowd-dispersing grenades, and a game of cat and mouse ensued in the narrow streets of the old town.
Hugh Schofield. Official figures issued on Saturday in Brazil show that hundreds of new fires are raging in the Amazon region as international pressure mounts on President Jair Bolsonaro over his environmental policies. More than 78,000 forest fires have been recorded in Brazil so far this year, most of them in the Amazon. Brazil's defence minister, Fernando Azevedo e Silva, said that the armed forces had already begun fighting the wildfires in the world's largest rainforest. Mr. Bolsonaro went on national television on Friday to announce the deployment of troops in the region to deal with the crisis. He also rejected criticism from European leaders who said the Amazon fires would be at the top of the current G7 meeting in France. Julian Marshall spoke to Tasso Azevedo, the first Director General of Brazil's National Forest Service, and asked him if the army had been used before in this particular role.
Not in controlling fire, but it has been used for support the operations to control deforestation, which is very crucial. Actually, the root of the fires are actually the deforestation. So this has happened before, especially between 2004 and 2012. And it was very important on the process to push down deforestation at that time. But it has to be a combined operation with IBAMA, you know, the environmental agencies and the others.
Does Brazil have what is needed to fight fires on this scale?
As any other country, we have like some of the resource, but you always need help when the size of the fire increases a lot. This happens everywhere in any country in the world. So it's no different for Brazil. Brazil will need help from outside or from the rain, from the skies, to actually stop the fires, because that's the dry season. And we are just in the beginning of the dry season. So we still have another 2 months, very, very critical ahead, which is September and October.
So Brazil on its own cannot stop these fires.
No, it's like you always need support. You know, the airplanes, we need logistics, resource. That's always has been the case. So we need to mobilize those resources.
That was Tasso Azevedo, the first Director General of Brazil's National Forest Service in Sao Paulo. The chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, has called on demonstrators who've been protesting for nearly 3 months now to sit down and talk and try to break the deadlock. On Saturday, there were renewed clashes between police and demonstrators in the territory. Officers in riot gear fired tear gas at activists, some of whom had thrown missiles at them. Our Hong Kong correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, and his cameraman, Johnny, were caught up in one of the charges.
So the riot police are coming through now. Coming in from several directions, they're telling people to clear out of the way, not running, but certainly striding in with great intent. And the protesters seem to have cleared out. We're also being moved along. Look out, Joey! Look out, Joey! Some sort of material which is on fire was thrown, seems, at the police. They've responded with tear gas and they're firing their own non-lethal rounds back at the protesters who've raced off in the other direction. So we have to put our masks on now. The peaceful standoff here in Hong Kong has come to an end. These riot police have moved in, forcing activists to push back, activists who've been throwing Molotov cocktails at them. Back here, these are the more radicalised youths. Many in the pro-democracy camp have tried to keep this weekend peaceful, but it hasn't worked out that way. This earlier on was a peaceful march, but then the more radicalised camp descended on the police station, started building barricades, and they say the reason for this is that the government here has come no closer to adhering to any of their demands.
That was Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. For the past week, thousands of Syrian families have been fleeing a government offensive in the last rebel stronghold of Idlib. the Syrian army, backed by Russia and Iran, has pushed rebels out of a string of villages and a strategic town in the northwest of the country. Hundreds of civilians have been killed after a ceasefire crumbled several months ago. All these developments have been covered by Radio Fresh, the only radio station still operating in Idlib. Our Middle East correspondent Martin Patience has been speaking to the station's staff.
أسعد الله أوقاتكم مستمعينا بكل خير أهلا ومرحبا بكم إلى هذه النشرة الإخبارية من راديو فريش.
It could be a radio station anywhere in the world. There are news programs, phone-ins, but then this happens.
مستمعينا في خبر عاجل وحسب.
Breaking news, says the presenter. A Russian jet has been spotted circling a village in Idlib. Radio Fresh was set up 6 years ago to provide what it says is independent news to the Syrian people. But its staff, including presenter Mahmoud al-Swayd, live and operate in a war zone.
Everyone who has stayed in the town has got a walkie-talkie. They use them to monitor aircraft. They don't leave the skies for a single moment. People only turn on the lights inside their house very occasionally. It's like being a ghost when you walk outside. Life has become very hard. Most of the shops and bakeries have shut down. You have to go to another area to be able to get formula for your baby.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Peace be upon you. Okay, I'm ready.
Ahmed Hunek is a dedicated listener.
I listen to Radio Fresh because keeping up with the news every moment and every minute and every hour. When I listen to Radio Fresh, I have full confidence in the news.
How many children do you have and what do you tell them when there's bombing?
I have 4 daughters. When I hear bombing, I try to protect them by taking them to shelters and calm them down.
What will you do if the regime keeps pushing into Idlib?
I will tell you with full confidence. I will carry my arms and join fighters and fight to the last breath in order to protect my land and honor and my family.
Many of the rebel groups are hardline Islamists. Do you worry about that?
Islamic groups are an excuse for making wars and crises.
The station was founded by prominent activist Raad al-Faris. He was opposed to the Syrian regime, but also an outspoken critic of the jihadist groups now operating in Idlib. He was murdered last year by unknown gunmen.
Hello, I'm Mahmoud Abbi.
Mahmoud runs the radio station's Facebook page.
How have the last few months been for you and your family?
We are so close to the fighting and we have fears of the revenge of the Assad regime.
How are you and your family coping?
We live somehow a normal life because we are... Somehow normal with war and fighting. We fear when the regime comes to our city that he will kill everybody. I have one baby. He is one day old.
First of all, Alf Mabruk, congratulations. I didn't realize you'd become a father. Your son, Zain, is only a day old. What do you think his future is?
It's a difficult question because we in general don't know what the future hides for us. But I work to make his future as good and as great as possible.
That was Mahmoud, an employee of Radio Fresh in the Syrian city of Idlib, and in that report from Martin Patience. Later in the podcast...
If they start mining, we cannot eat the crab if we can catch it. But I think all the crab will die in this area, and if they don't die, they will escape from this fjord.
A way of life under threat in the Arctic. Next to Germany, and an estimated 40,000 people have turned out in the city of Dresden for a rally against far-right extremism ahead of state elections in Saxony next weekend. Organisers said the response far exceeded their expectations. With more details, here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Saxony is a stronghold of the anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany party, and Dresden is the cradle of the anti-Islam Pegida movement. So campaigners promoting a different view were delighted with the turnout for their rally, promoted under the hashtag Indivisible. Saxony's Integration Minister Petra Köpping said it sent an important signal. The Turkish-German lawyer Seda Başay Yildiz, who's been subjected to death threats, said it showed that Saxony did not belong to Nazis and rabble-rousers. Alternative for Germany rejects both labels. Opinion polls suggest it's on course for a quarter of the vote next week.
That was Mike Sanders. Prince Andrew has defended his former friendship with the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, saying that at no stage did he see or suspect any criminal behaviour. Mr. Epstein took his own life in prison earlier this month while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. Queen Elizabeth's second son said he wanted to clarify the facts around his association with the US financier. I asked our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell for more on the statement from Buckingham Palace.
There's been such a spate of stories, particularly here in the UK press over the past week, that I think Prince Andrew now feels that he wants to get his version of events out there. He is essentially saying three things. He's saying that he saw Jeffrey Epstein infrequently, although he acknowledges that he went to his residences. And the central point to which you've already alluded, he says that he did not see, witness or suspect any behaviour of the sort that led him to be convicted for paedophilia. And he acknowledges that it was then a mistake and an error, to use his words, for him to have visited Epstein after his release from prison. And that, I think, is where he is still facing some difficulty. By then, nobody could claim that they weren't aware of what sort of a man this was. And yet, there was Prince Andrew in New York, in Central Park, photographed, and of course, most damningly, as it were, apparently, at his house.
And there were a number of days between the statement coming out of Buckingham Palace, four or five days ago, and this statement. Do you think this statement goes far enough to, in some way, rebuild his reputation?
I think the questions will continue. I don't think this will quell them. It places his already emphatic denials of impropriety, which the Buckingham Palace has already made on several occasions. They have quoted him as saying that the kind of behaviour that Mr. Epstein was capable of was abhorrent to him. But I think that he will still face some difficulty, purely because he insisted on continuing some sort of a friendship or a relationship with a convicted paedophile. And that is pretty uncomfortable for the Queen's second son.
Indeed. Is it damaging for the wider royal family?
Well, it's certainly not helpful. I mean, it's not been a good few weeks, frankly, for the British monarchy. All the stories about Harry and Meghan going off on private jets. I mean, it's quite a different sort of category of thing. But it's unhelpful, you know, and a 93-year-old monarch, Queen Elizabeth, must sort of sometimes think, gosh, I wish my family would just sort of recognise the way in which we are expected to behave.
That was Nicholas Witchell. Now to Kenya, and the authorities say that more than 140,000 police officers are being deployed to help monitor the country's largest ever national census, which has just begun. It's the first time where all data are being recorded on mobile devices. Will Ross reports.
Across Kenya, census officials with their tablets are knocking on doors and asking questions which in theory should help the government improve its policy-making decisions. Kenya is the first country in Africa to collect data on people who don't identify as male or female. The registering of intersex people in a national census is seen as a major victory for rights activists. But in a country where corruption scandals are common, there is concern that the exercise is set to cost close to $180 million. Some are also worried that the collection of sensitive personal information in a digital format is risky, given that Kenya doesn't have robust data protection laws.
Will Ross. Now, it's being called the first crime in space. That is, if it results in a conviction. An American astronaut, Anne McClain, has denied any wrongdoing after allegedly accessing the bank account of her estranged spouse from the International Space Station. The astronaut's lawyer said that she was merely making sure that the family's finances were in order and there was enough money to pay their bills. But Ms. McClain's spouse has filed a complaint with the US Federal Trade Commission. Professor Chris Newman is Professor of Space Law and Policy at Northumbria University in Northern England. Julian Marshall asked him, how can you commit a crime in space when it's outside the jurisdiction of planet Earth?
There is this popular misconception that space is somewhere outside the law, but actually it's not. At the start of the space race, one of the earliest discussions within the United Nations was on this exact question of how do we govern space activity? And the eventual arrangement that states came up with was the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. And that's sort of an overarching international treaty, which provides for some very broad principles on the way in which human activity in space is governed. And it effectively subcontracts responsibility for space activities to nation states, which is kind of not surprising when you think about the time of the treaty being drafted, 1967, just before humans landed on the moon. What happened then was geopolitics changed and it no longer required a superpower budget to go into space. And at about that time, the International Space Station came on the scene. So the International Space Station still works within the Outer Space Treaty framework, but it's got a special intergovernmental agreement, the IGA.
So in this particular instance, an offence has allegedly been committed by one US national against another. That falls within the jurisdiction of the United States.
Exactly so. And something of a misnomer to call this an allegation of space crime, because it's not really. It's a very terrestrial dispute that just happens to have a space context.
But the offence, insofar as bank records were accessed from the IAS, surely makes it a crime committed in space, or allegedly.
Yeah, it is a crime where part of the allegation involves a human in space, and that's where the interest occurs. In a sense, it's in an environment where there is international regulation, and other than that, no difference to international waters or Antarctica or something like that.
In this particular instance, if the alleged offence is to be properly investigated, would it not involve investigators accessing files, communications files on the International Space Station? Is that going to be allowed?
I wouldn't like to say how the investigation on this particular incident would proceed. But as a general sort of insight, I would think that because the participants are all within one jurisdiction, the normal rules of investigation will apply, the normal rules of disclosure will apply, and accessing any files shouldn't be overly problematic anyway.
Over the years, I've covered a lot of stories about space debris. Might environmentalists have any kind of case in space law for prosecuting those responsible for disseminating that space debris?
The first thing about any criminal sanction is there has to be a recognised sovereign authority behind it to enforce the sanction. The Outer Space Treaty of 1967 does not impose any specific duties regarding debris. It doesn't impose any obligations on space actors. So the treaty is very loosely framed and designed to enshrine principles rather than specific ideas of liability.
That was Chris Newman with the rather fantastic title, Professor of Space Law and Policy at Northumbria University in Northern England. Few places have experienced the effects of climate change as vividly as the Arctic. Scientists say temperatures in the far north have risen by more than 2 degrees Celsius since the Industrial Revolution. That's twice the global average. In Finnmark, at the northernmost tip of Norway, the change is a challenge for indigenous Sami reindeer herders. But one solution, to mine copper for a shift to electric vehicles and wind turbines, may make things even worse for the Sami, as our correspondent James Cook has been finding out.
Niels Mathis-Sera is a Sami chief at the top of the world. He's been herding reindeer since he was a boy. The weather is etched in his face. It's a way of life that stretches into the distant past. But now he's worried about the future.
This is life-changing. If this mine becomes reality, that makes the chance of survival impossible, both economically and mentally. At my age, we can manage somehow, but the young, they're in a dark, dark time.
The chief and his daughter Inga are fighting plans for a copper mine, which they say will disrupt their reindeer and damage the environment.
Maybe we have to take a look at our lifestyle. Where are we actually going? Can we just continue further with the Western lifestyle?
But exploration is already underway. High up a hill where the reindeer come to calve, a drill is boring into the earth.
Where the mine waste is put into the ocean, that will destroy life. Because
Norway's Minister of Trade and Industry, Torbjørn Roe Isaksen, says his government approved the project because the need for copper outweighs the disruption it will bring.
It's true that the Arctic is beautiful, but for us, for Norwegians, it's also a place where we actually live. And if the world doesn't have more copper, we won't be able to build more windmills, won't be able to have the huge shift to electrical cars, for example, that we need.
The government says fish will be protected from the waste by strict environmental standards. Okay. In the fjord where the mine's debris will be dumped, Einar Julesson is hauling up a basket of very large crabs.
Yeah, it's a middle size of crab.
These are middle sized.
Yes, it's middle sized.
They look pretty big to me. For Einar, the government's assurances do not hold water.
If they start mining, we cannot eat the crab if we can catch it. But I think all the crab will die in this area. And if they don't die, they will escape from this fjord.
Along the shores of this sleepy fjord, there is some support for the mine.
I haven't made a final decision, to put it that way, because there are two things. One, the environment. We have to protect it. Two, we need jobs.
But for the Sami reindeer herders like Inga Sera, that does not sound like a future full of promise.
It's like taking more and more lands. It's mining, it's power lines, it's wind power. And when you take indigenous people's lands, what's left?
That was the Sami reindeer herder Inga Sera, and in that report by James Cook in the Norwegian Arctic. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.